You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5.
And now we step into Diabetes and You with a guest host this afternoon, Mr. Brian Cockburn. Good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Never mind the fancy spelling. That's Cockburn.
Cockburn. And welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM. And it's over to you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon to our listeners on Freedom 106 FM. I'm Brian Cockburn, Professor of Biochemistry at the St. Augustine campus of the University of the West Indies and Second Vice President of the Diabetes Association of Trinidad and Tobago. I'm standing in for our President, Dr. Andrew Danu, who is unable to be with us today. I'd like to take a moment to remind the listeners that we have free diabetic eye screening continuing for the month. Call DATT at 607-3288 for an appointment. That's 607-3288. And also, the finals of the diabetes school quiz are set for June 5th. And today, we're joined by Dr. Vinita Shukla. Dr. Shukla is a dedicated pediatric neurologist focused on advancing clinical care and improving outcomes for children with neurological disorders. She believes every child deserves top quality care and has consistently worked to enhance pediatric neurology services throughout her career. Her pediatric career began in 2010 under the mentorship of Dr. Marlon Timothy. That foundational period facilitated the development of a strong clinical acumen and a patient-centered approach, culminated in the completion of her DM pediatrics training in 2016. Seeking to broaden her expertise and bring advanced care techniques back to her home institution, she undertook a two-year senior clinical fellowship in pediatric neurology at the Bristol Royal Hospital for Children in the UK, one of only four national centers for pediatric epilepsy surgery. There, she gained hands-on experience in complex movement disorders, neurorehabilitation, and childhood stroke, while actively contributing to the center's acclaimed pediatric neuromuscular service. She returned to Trinidad and Tobago in 2020 to establish the pediatric neurology service at the Eric Williams Medical Sciences Complex. In October 2023, the team completed TNT's first pediatric resective epilepsy surgery, expanding local surgical options. From 2022 to 2023, she furthered her training in pediatric epilepsy and clinical neurophysiology at the University of British Columbia, gaining expertise in advanced diagnostic and treatment protocols. Dr. Shukla is currently a lecturer in child health at the University of the West Indies. Additionally, she serves as Secretary of the Pediatric Society of Trinidad and Tobago and is actively engaged with the International League Against Epilepsy. She's dedicated to advancing the field and ensuring that children across the region receive the highest standard of neurological care. Welcome, Dr. Shukla, and thank you for agreeing to be here and sharing your knowledge with families living with diabetes and all of our listeners.
Thank you so much, Prof. Cockburn, for having me.
Okay, and our topic for today is diabetes and the brain in children. Dr. Shukla, can you tell us about your journey into medicine? We heard some of how you specialize, but tell us about your journey into medicine and what inspired you to specialize in pediatric neurology.
So I always wanted to be a doctor from childhood. So when I was younger, I always wanted to actually be a pediatrician. and you know, that drive to be you know, a doctor, to be in the medical field, you know, that was my driving force. There was nothing, you know, in my history that would have pushed me either way. But, you know, that's just something I always wanted to do, and take care of kids. So I would have done my medical training, so my MBBS degree at the University of the West Indies, after completing, at that time it was A-levels, right? And I would have finished that in 2009. And because I always wanted to do pediatrics, I would have explored different pathways to becoming a pediatrician. And luckily, we do have a program for specializing in pediatrics locally within the University of the West Indies. So, you know, I took that path and finally completed that in 2016, as you had mentioned. And during that time, you know, we weren't exposed as much to the pediatric subspecialties as, you know, as we are today. And I was drawn to kids with cerebral palsy and children with special needs during my pediatric training. I also like neonatology. However, my, you know, perspective shifted a bit during the latter years of my training, and that's when I was focused more on brain health as well as neurological conditions in children, and exploring how we could help them and get better care for them locally. So that's what really drew me into pediatric neurology. I do see a lot of kids with neurological conditions, and they don't always, you know, present the way that we expect them to present. They don't present from birth. Some of them develop neurological problems later on, and it is difficult for the families and caregivers to understand why, you know, because it's the brain affected. Especially in a child that was probably developing normally before, you know, before something happened. So, I mean, that is another journey that, within the pediatric neurology specialty, that is one of the more difficult things to manage.
Dr. Shukla, you've taken us directly into the meat of the matter.
Yes.
And along that vein, if you could tell us, please, just for all our listeners, clarify what exactly is pediatric neurology and what are some of the conditions you commonly treat in children?
Right. So good question. So pediatric neurology is the management of brain, spine, and the nervous system disorders in children, right? So pediatric children. And we typically see, even before birth, there might be a neurological issue that would have developed or would be monitored during pregnancy, that, you know, we would have to get involved with before the baby is born. So we see kids from, you know, we see babies and up until 18 years old usually, even though in the hospital setting we cut off at 16 years old. So, I mean, that's what pediatric neurology is. It encompasses a lot of different areas. But, you know, commonly what we see and what we manage are children with seizures most often, right, or epilepsy, children who have neurological symptoms, for example, headaches, we'd also have children who have more sensory issues, So they would have either increase in sensation or decrease in sensation. And we see patients in a spectrum. So we might see children in the outpatient setting. We'd see children coming into emergency and admitted to the ward with new diagnoses, as well as children with chronic conditions, so genetic conditions, metabolic conditions that affect the nervous system. So affect the brain, it affects the muscles, it affects the nerves. It can also affect the spine. And we also manage a lot of children with special needs and developmental concerns, because those are the kids who have a higher risk of having a more acute and chronic neurological, neurological conditions. Yeah, so that's it in a nutshell.
Right. And can any of these conditions go undetected? I mean, how subtle are they?
Yeah, so they could be, especially if you have a child who has an underlying genetic condition, a new gene that pops up, not in the family, but this child probably has a genetic condition and developing nicely normally, and then all of a sudden you may notice, like in school, like in a school setting, so a different setting, they may exhibit a different personality or a different behavior compared to what we call typical children or typical brains. So in those cases, we might have children who are more restless in class, or, you know, they fight, you know, they don't understand certain subjects, or however they may understand other things more than their peers, right? So you know, they might be fixated on something, and that's usually when, you know, you might see things kind of cropping up at that time. As well as other conditions, it usually does kind of, it doesn't start from birth, right? Some of them would start from birth, but some of them would start later on. And a lot of times when we try always to find the cause of it, right? So what is the underlying cause of why this child's nervous system is not functioning well? And then we try as much as possible to treat that underlying cause.
Hey, excellent. So, because this is the Diabetes Association, I'm obliged to ask you, how can diabetes affect the brain and the nervous system in children and teenagers?
So, very similar to how it may affect adults. In children, type 1 diabetes, however, would be more common. Whereas type 2 would be the more common type in adults, right? Now, the brain likes balance, right? And with diabetes, you have a problem with the balance of glucose. So glucose is actually the substrate that the brain relies on most, right, for its energy. And it doesn't store glucose. That's the problem. So the brain won't store glucose, so it would rely on a supply of glucose from the rest of the body or through the blood. Now, how it affects the brain is that you can have highs of glucose, you can have lows of glucose. And with diabetes, we think more of the highs. And with high blood glucose, it could, you know, that consistently high sugar level could actually cause a mild inflammation in the brain and the blood vessels of the brain. And, you know, the symptoms that could develop would be like brain fog, right, where kids may struggle with memory, their processing speed, and even attention, right? And these are some things that we might only notice in school, etc., in the school age setting. Now, the lower blood sugar, right, so the brain, as I mentioned, it relies on glucose to produce, you know, to work. And if the blood sugar drops too low, then the brain is essentially starved of that substrate, right? Or that their fuel. So to protect itself, it might start to fire off abnormal electrical signals, right? Because of that low blood glucose, and that could cause or provoke seizure, right? And you know, we know the symptoms, so I know you all do a lot of advocacy and information sharing on this platform, and we know that, you know, hypoglycemia in itself, there are symptoms, so the child might become shaky, confused, or even spaced out even before they go on to having a full-blown seizure. Now, long-term, because the brain likes that balance, if there are very frequent severe lows or highs, you know, the brains are in a stage of development in kids, and you know, we need to see whether that would impact on their long-term brain health if they aren't able to balance that glucose shift. So that's how the, you know, diabetes could affect the brain in children and some of the symptoms that might be noticed in children who are diagnosed with diabetes.
So to be clear, both low and high blood sugar levels can trigger seizures or other neurological problems in children?
Yes, yeah. So mainly low blood sugar. We think about the low blood sugar and the hypoglycemic seizures. Now, high blood sugars can more trigger what we call raised pressure in the brain, right? Like, for example, if a child presents with diabetic ketoacidosis, in that perspective, children may present with seizures as well. So both highs and lows could present with seizures.
Okay. So now, on the subject of seizures, if a child with diabetes has a seizure, what should parents, teachers, or caregivers do in those moments before medical help arrives?
Right, so that's a good question as well. Seizure safety is important. Now, if a child has a seizure and they're known to have diabetes, but there isn't a way for us at that moment to check their blood sugar level, then we focus on managing the emergency, which is the seizures, right? So first thing, you make sure the child is safe. Turn them to their side, right? Don't put anything in their mouth, right? I know the old adage was to put a spoon in their mouth, put a nutmeg, etc. But try not to put anything in the child's mouth because, you know, the jaw is locked and, you know, don't want to compromise and their airway, right? So you turn them to their side. That would help the tongue fall to the side as well so as not to obstruct the airway. And you make sure the child is safe, call for help, just stay with them until help comes. That's basically what we tell parents to do in the event that they have a seizure and is not in a medical facility, etc.
Right. Is it important to time the seizures?
Yes, of course. So timing the seizures would be important. Some persons do. So if you're in an area where there are more than one person around, someone could probably video the event so that the medical practitioners could also know what type of seizure is it, and is it fitting with the underlying condition, the diabetes itself, or could it be something else that we have to be looking at? So timing is also important, that's correct, and as well as a witness a witness statement or a witness video.
Oh, that's very useful. And when you say ensure that the child is safe, you mean move hard and sharp objects away, maybe cushion the head?
Yeah. So make sure they're on their side so that the tongue falls to the side and not obstruct the airway, and cushion the head as much as possible. Yes.
Okay. Now, there are some people who might be trained to administer glucagon. Is that something that maybe is also suggested, or you would not want to put that on the table for
those?
Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's fine. No, but that's a good, as a fair point. Now, for kids who having a lot of lows and having seizures because of that, right, hypoglycemic seizures, then, you know, there might be a reason to adjust their medication so that they don't have so many lows, right? So that's the first thing I would suggest. If it is that, you know, they get help, you know, medical help, and they are able to cite an IV access, etc., to give blood glucose to reverse the seizure, then, you know, that would be more the first line management for hypoglycemic seizures. But I do take your point about that glucagon, you know, glucagon to help raise the blood sugar if it is indeed a hypoglycemic seizure. However, I don't think that we have, I'm not sure we train our parents and caregivers around that, but that is a good point for us to consider for the future, especially right. Children who, you know, we know might be at risk of that.
Right, but absolutely only for those who have received training to administer.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, I think at this time, we need to go to a commercial break, but we'll return briefly to the subject of seizures after the commercial. So, over to you, Bass, for a commercial break.
When you need the independence to speak your mind, you take it on the all-new talk radio, Freedom, 106.5 FM.
She's the one who listens, who nurtures, who shows up every single time. This Mother's Day, celebrate her. Every mom, grandmother, aunt, caregiver, and woman who shaped your world. At Superfarm, find thoughtful gifts she always loves, from beautiful fragrances and skincare to flowers, chocolates, wellness essentials, and so much more. 11 locations nationwide open earlier and later to suit you. Superfarm, your prescription of trust.
Get the story first. Want to know what's happening in news, sports, or crime? Get the CNC3 app. As the story breaks, CNC3 is there giving you the story first on your mobile device. Be connected to the most trusted and reliable news source, CNC3. Access your world with just a tap. The CNC3 app. Download it today. Go big, go digital, go everywhere with the Big Board Company. With 15 high-impact digital billboard locations across the country, the Big Board Company puts your brand where it belongs. Front and center with state-of-the-art LED screens in the most high-traffic areas across the country, you are guaranteed to be seen. Get flexible scheduling, real-time updates, and the most eye-catching and dynamic visuals. With free artwork from local businesses to national brands, we bring reach and visibility like nobody else does. 15 locations, endless possibilities. Advertise with the Big Board Company and get that Big Board impact. Call 723-9595. For more information.
All right, folks, so we now return to Diabetes and You. We have Dr. Brian Cockburn in for Dr. Andrew Danu today with his very special guest.
Hi, thank you. I see that fancy name continues to pose challenges That's Coburn.
Oh, Coburn. I'm sorry, sir.
No worries. We continue here on Freedom 106 FM. Subject for today is diabetes and the brain in children. And our special guest is Dr. Vanita Shukla. Dr. Shukla, we were just talking about seizures and what should be done. An interesting assumption here is that even after the seizure has passed, that we should seek medical attention. Is that correct?
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm.
Right. And what is the importance of that? Because one might feel, well, okay, it's passed, all is well now. No need to seek medical attention.
Right. So, I mean, that's a good question. Now, remember with, you know, and anybody who has a seizure, right, that's an increase in the electrical activity of the brain, right? So what we see as seizures or motor movements, right, or the typical seizure movements that, you know, that we are aware of, that is a clinical change, right? Now, even after that, the clinical symptoms have settled, the brain can still be very highly electric, right? So the reason why we say to still seek medical attention even after a seizure has happened is we want to make sure that in fact the seizure has abated and there's not any ongoing, what we call subclinical seizures or subtle seizures that we can't see a motor symptom for. Because if the seizure continues, right, then that would, you know, affect the activity of the brain, where the child would not be able to wake up appropriately, or they might have what we call clusters of seizures that may not be able to stop if we don't address it early. So that's why we would like our patients to seek medical attention even if the clinical symptoms have subsided.
Right. And of course the concern and the focus, of course, is that even after it's passed, we want to prevent it from recurring.
Correct, yes.
All right. Now, changing gears slightly, epilepsy is also a condition that we keep hearing about. But what is epilepsy? And how has treatment for epilepsy advanced over the years, especially here in Trinidad and Tobago?
Right. So a patient would be diagnosed with epilepsy if they have two or more, this is the simple definition, two or more unprovoked seizures that have occurred more than 24 hours apart, right? Now, this does not include hypoglycemic seizures because that would mean that the seizures have been provoked by an event, right? So, for example, if a seizure is provoked by fever, change in the salt levels in the blood, and low blood glucose or even high blood glucose, that would not make a patient epileptic, all right? Especially if we find a provoking factor. So epilepsy would be the absence of a provoking factor leading to seizures. That means that we can't predict when it's going to happen or what causes the child to have that seizure at that moment. Now, management of epilepsy initially would be based on, you know, the patient we have in front of us, right? Now, we don't want recurrent seizures to occur in our kids. And then there are different types of seizures as well. So there could be very, very subtle seizures where the child just stares off, right? But if they stare off and they are not responsive many times for the day and they lose time, that could affect their school function and their school performance, right? And they miss time because they miss time. Now, so as I mentioned, it all depends on the type of seizure that we have and the cause of the child's epilepsy. Now, if it is that this is a child who has epilepsy syndrome that they could grow out of, right, because we have heard of children growing out of their epilepsy, then, you know, we could choose an appropriate anti-seizure medication. And that's, you know, once they are seizure-free for more than 2 years, usually they could come off of the medication, right? Now, in children who have different types of seizures, or, you know, the seizure burden is so much that it affects the function of the brain or causes slowing of the brain waves, then those children are the ones that we would be concerned about, and we would explore other options, especially if medication is not working. So we might look at certain diets, right? So one of them is the ketogenic diet, which is a high-fat diet. High fat, low glucose diet that has worked for some children with epilepsy, as well as surgical options. Surgical options, again, is based on the cause of the child's epilepsy and how the seizures affect their quality of life. So locally, we do have, we have done epilepsy surgery in children whose seizures were very difficult to treat with medication alone, and you know, they may not have responded to that special ketogenic diet, or it would have been what we call not right for that child, right? Because it is a special diet, a very high fat diet. It might be restricted. And not all kids would, you know, would respond to the diet well. So we have had cases where we would have done epilepsy surgery to help that child's epilepsy burden or seizure burden, especially if it is that there is something causing the seizures that we could see on a scan. So, for example, a benign tumor or an abnormal folding at the brain that is not impacting on their motor function, then we would do epilepsy surgery or focal epilepsy surgery is what we call it. And then there are other surgical options that we could do. I know privately, Dr. Pandey, and they have done some vagal nerve stimulation surgeries, which are less invasive than brain surgery. And pediatrics, we do we disconnect the left and right sides of the brain to prevent the propagation of seizures. And children who have epilepsy that affects the brain function, or they have slowing of their brain. So, I mean, those are things that, you know, we have done locally as well, just to advance the epilepsy care part in Trinidad and Tobago.
Okay. Could you tell us, Dr. Shukla, you mentioned that in some cases the ketogenic diet is contraindicated or not recommended. What would make someone not a good candidate for this approach?
Right. So children in general, so sometimes the options that we have available to do a ketogenic diet, we would not be able to do a pure ketogenic diet because of our, you know, food options here. So that's one. Locally, we might be limited, and we might offer a modified ketogenic diet. The second thing is what we have available for doing a modified or a pure ketogenic diet. Some kids just won't take to that, right? So they won't like the taste of it. It wouldn't be, as you say, palatable to them. However, there are children who feed via a gastrostomy tube. They would more be, able to tolerate that ketogenic diet, right? Because we could give them it via the tube. So those would be main things as to why a child would not, tolerate or like the ketogenic diet. And there are conditions where the ketogenic diet, so genetic conditions again, where the ketogenic diet would be, the treatment of choice, but it's not many, it's very rare as well. And that's only if, they have those specific conditions or genetic conditions that we would say, okay, they have to follow that ketogenic diet.
Okay, thank you. Now, it can come as quite a surprise that children can have strokes.
Yes.
What causes childhood stroke? Are there links between diabetes and stroke risk later in life?
Right, so that's a good question. So I'll start with the diabetes part. So what happens with a stroke is that, there's a blockage of blood flow to part of the brain, or a blood vessel could burst, right? So that's basically what a stroke is. And it is rare in children, but even rarer in children with diabetes compared to adults with diabetes. However, what could happen is that high blood sugar could make the lining of the blood vessels very sticky, and is not as, compliant, and that would make it easy for clots to form in those blood vessels. So that's one thing that could happen with high blood sugar and diabetes and strokes. Now, a next thing that could happen, and a lot of kids usually when they first present with diabetes, because the symptoms again are so subtle, they could present with what we call diabetic ketoacidosis, right? And in these cases, the child themselves would be very dehydrated, and that would thicken the blood flow through those vessels, and that in itself again increases the risk of a clot. So usually in the in the acute setting, so for diabetic ketoacidosis, dehydration, high blood sugar, sticky vessels, poor flow of blood through those vessels could increase that stroke risk. And then longer term, if the high blood sugar is not managed appropriately, it causes stickiness of the blood vessels, and it makes the vessels develop clots more easily. So that's from a diabetes perspective and how it could cause strokes in children. Although rare, it could happen. There are other causes of childhood stroke, and locally, the most common one would be sickle cell disease. So that is we have a very high percentage of persons in Trinidad and Tobago with sickle cell disease because of our ethnic backgrounds. And what happens is that the cells themselves are not nice and pliable to go through the vessels, but they're kind of C-shaped, and that could cause blockage in blood vessels as well. So that's one of the most common causes of stroke in children in our setting. Other causes of stroke not related to diabetes could be if a child has a heart disorder, congenital heart disorder. Infections could cause strokes as well. Certain infections like chickenpox or post viruses, any kind of inflammation in blood vessels could predispose a child to stroke as well. So those would be the main causes of stroke in children, and how it relates to diabetes. Although rare, it can happen in the acute setting as well as if blood sugars aren't controlled well.
Oh, really? Thank you for that, Dr. Shukla. I think it's time for us to go to our second commercial break now.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability, the all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5. Everywhere with the Big Board Company. With 15 high-impact digital billboard locations across the country, the Big Board Company puts your brand where it belongs. Front and center with state-of-the-art LED screens in the most high-traffic areas across the country, you are guaranteed to be seen. Get flexible scheduling, real-time updates, and the most eye-catching and dynamic visuals. With free artwork from local businesses to national brands, we bring reach and visibility like nobody else does. 15 locations, endless possibilities. Advertise with the Big Board Company and get that Big Board impact. Call 723-9595. For more information. When the issues matter, the conversation starts here. From politics to the economy, from social justice to national development, nothing is off the table. Weekdays, Monday to Friday, 6 to 9 a.m., Davy Marie brings you the Morning Rumble on Freedom 106.5 FM. Hard-hitting topics, informative, credible guests, experts who don't just talk, they break it down. If you want clarity, accountability, and real discussion on the issues shaping your day and your country, there's only one place to be. The Morning Rumble, weekday 6 to 9 a.m. on Freedom 106.5 FM. Speak your mind.
Get ready for a day of fun, excitement, and giving back. The Trinidad and Tobago Guardian Neediest Cases Fund presents the Bingo Charity Event. Join us on Sunday, May 24th from 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Lions Cultural Center, Woodbrook. Play for your chance to win up to $10,000. Registration is just $200 and includes two bingo cards with additional cards and refreshments on sale. Get your tickets now at Dominican Book Center, St. Fimbus Cheers Grounds, Mourne Coco Road, Four Roads, Dago Martin, and now also at Tattle Head Office, Marva Road, Port of Spain. For more info, call 343-2218 or WhatsApp 799-8550. The Bingo Charitable Initiative. Play, win, and support a great cause.
All right, people, remember June 1st to the 3rd, the Hyatt Regency. Don't miss the Trinidad and Tobago Disaster Risk Management Conference and Expo. Real stories and experience live scenarios. Register now at the ttdrm.com, because the only thing worse than a disaster is being unprepared. 10 minutes away from 1 o'clock, special edition today of Diabetes and You. We have Dr. Brian Coburn in for Andrew Danu today.
Thank you, Bass. And continuing our subject for today, diabetes and the brain in children, with our guest, Dr. Vanita Shukla. Dr. Shukla. What are some neurological warning signs in children that parents should never ignore?
Specific for diabetes, or you want me to be broader?
You can be broad and narrow as necessary.
Right. Yeah. Okay, great. So specific warning signs, it all depends on the age of the child, as well as how it develops. So I would start with a baby, and then we could go from there. So babies, you know, what we look at with regards to warning signs would be, so seizures are never good. If the baby is not waking up appropriately, as well as if the baby is not developing skills, right? So in that first year of life, you're worried that, you know, baby's development might not be as, you know, it might not be progressing the way that, you know, everybody has been telling you it would be, or if you have experience compared to your other kids. So those would be the main things in a baby and in infancy. Now, as they move on to like that school age time, when a lot could happen, you know, subtle signs can be if they aren't keeping up with their friends at school, if they aren't making friends easily, or they're getting into a lot of fights, or their behavior in school is of concern, meaning that they might be really overstimulated at school for some reason, and you see a big shift in their behavior from school to home, etc. As well as I mentioned, they may have specific disabilities when it comes to certain subjects. So those would be in school and in the more the outpatient setting. Again, seizures throughout life, right? So from baby to adolescence or teenage years, even into adults, it is never, you know, we have to try to figure out why this child is having or young person is having a seizure. Now, as they get older, in that teenage years, any regression in their skills, so if they've learned as a developmental skill and then they've lost it, that's not a good sign. As well as when they get older, any change in their mood is up and down. They were previously really good in their academic work, and then suddenly they start complaining of headaches. They have a change in their personality, etc. So those would be things that we'd be concerned about and have to again figure out why this child is having these events. So I would say, in a broader perspective, we think about how patients present throughout their lifespan. And as it relates to diabetes, so as I mentioned, the brain likes balance, right? And we think about problems with blood sugar, so a low blood sugar, a high blood sugar, and we talked about what could happen and why that affects the brain. So with low blood sugars, even before they get a patient would get a seizure, they might be very drowsy, they might be listless, they might be restless, they might have tremors. So all of those are little signs that, their blood sugars may be dropping too low. And then if they are, if they are having lots of highs, then they could also have signs that, that their brain is under pressure, and they might have vomiting, they might have headaches, as well as seizures if it gets out of control. So those would be the signs that I would say to look out for in children if you're concerned about a neurological issue, as well as, specific to children with diabetes.
Okay, thank you. Now, so you've been practicing for a while in Trinidad and Tobago. What progress would you say Trinidad and Tobago has made in pediatric neurology care, and what areas still need improvement?
Yeah, so we always need to advance care locally. I think with regards to what we have available now, not just in pediatric neurology, but, we have a lot of interconnectivity between the pediatricians as well as the, subspecialties. So we have a lot of subspecialty care available at every stage of a child's life. We have neonatal care as well as adolescent care. So we have adolescent pediatrics, and because of that and because of that interconnectivity, I think that pediatric care compared to maybe 10 years ago has really advanced. Now we have to keep up with that. And not all the time that we would have the resources available to diagnose children with rare conditions, or to work them up to rule things out or in, and help parents, come to terms with what's happening with their child. So, with regards to we have a lot of a subspecialty care available. We still do go clinically, right? When we see a patient, it all goes back to history and examination and, a timeline. But sometimes to move that extra step, we need resources, to diagnose patients and to treat patients even with medications that may not be available locally, or treatments that may not be available locally. And I think that's where we have to go next, as well as research in our specific population, because we have a nice mix of different ethnicities in the Caribbean compared to all over the world. And because of that, we may be susceptible to certain conditions that have not been studied in other regions. So, I mean, with regards to research, treatment, and resources, I think we still have a long way to go, but hopefully, you know, we get there.
So, what's the biggest takeaway message you would like our parents, caregivers, and young people to remember about protecting children's brain health?
Okay, so, you know, we may not always do it, right? I myself am guilty, right? But, you know, staying hydrated is always important. As I mentioned, you know, I keep saying the brain likes balance, right? And parents do know their kids best, right? And I know they try to give them the best that they could. But, you know, simple measures. So, avoiding dehydration, making sure a child stays hydrated, always ensuring that, you know, they have good physical activity, so they're not just, you know, at home or on their devices, because, you know, regular exercise improves blood flow to the brain and it increases the brain's ability to form new connections. And it helps with stress as well, right? So physical activity leads to less stress, as well as, you know, making sure that your kids get a good sleep pattern, right? And I know, again, that may not always be, you know, you may not always be able to regulate that, especially in the teenage years. But, you know, having a consistent sleep schedule would regulate children better, regulate their hormones, and help them clear out that metabolic waste during more, like, deeper sleep. So those would be the main things I would say to focus on, as well as, you know, keeping a good connection with, you know, your neighbors, as well as your school, right? So the education system that your child is in, you know, keeping a good connection with them so that, because they may notice things that you may not notice at home. So those would be the key things I would say.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Shukla. I have one more for you. So the word dementia has entered our vocabulary here in Trinidad and Tobago, but it's really not well known that childhood dementia also exists. Is there anything you, really briefly, I know it's not fair to ask you to condense it, is there anything really briefly you can tell us about childhood dementia?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it's not as common as adult dementia and childhood dementia. So dementia is an umbrella term, especially in kids, where the causes of dementia or regression or slowing is usually either a genetic cause or what we call a metabolic cause. So a problem with, you know, breaking down substances in the blood or an accumulation of toxic substances in the brain. So, I mean, because of that, dementia in children, you know, is not a very comforting diagnosis, but it is rare. You know, that dementia in children is rare. We always look for things that we could treat in pediatrics, right? So a lot of research in the pipelines with regards to these rare causes of dementia, and certain vitamins and substances and substrates do help in certain cases depending on what is lacking. But I mean, in childhood dementia, I think it's rare, but a lot of times when we see children with childhood dementia, we do try again to find a cause, and if it is something genetic or treatable, then, you know, we try our best to source that treatment for our kids.
Okay, Dr. Shukla, we probably could go on for another hour talking here. I'd like to really thank you for sharing your knowledge with us.
Not a problem.
It's been fascinating, and I know our listeners would have been really pleased. And before we go, just want to remind our listeners that free diabetic eye screening continues throughout the month of May. Please call the Diabetic Association at 607-3288 to make an appointment. It's free and can make a huge impact on preserving vision. Thank you again, Dr. Shukla, and thank you to all our listeners here on Freedom 106 FM.
All right, thank you very much, people. Diabetes and You Special Edition. Thank you very much to Dr. Coburn for filling in for Dr. Andrew Daniel, who should be back in next week. All right, you've been listening to Diabetes and You right here on Freedom 106.5.
You're tuned into the all-new Freedom 106.5.